the censors will be up in arms. Hello, welcome to Crave, the podcast dedicated to music, movies, television, theatre, in fact, just about anything that's been entertaining me, Simon Mercep, and Steve McCabe lately.
And this week, we've got Hollywood trotting out a female version of Ghostbusters last year, and now we've got another bit of gender swapping. We've just had a new film hitting the big screen with Sandra Bullock, Kate Blanchett, and some serious acting talent backing them up. And that's going to be Ocean's 8.
It is. Kate Blanchett, of course, fantastic Australian actor, and so is Toni Collette. She leads another top-notch cast in a film dubbed the scariest to come along since The Exorcist. This is a film called Hereditary.
Now, winter is upon us, which means that the big names in music are now playing their trade in the northern summer. They're doing the big arena show, the big stadium shows up there, but we're getting a few big arena performances down here. So what we've had recently in Auckland has been Niall Horan from One Direction.
We have indeed. You may recall that a few months ago now, but in our summer, I was really taken with a live performance at the Auckland City Limits Festival by a teenage heavy metal band from Northland called Alien Weaponry.
Yes, I remember you speaking very highly of them.
Yeah, I'm not a heavy metal fan, but they've just come out with a new album. It's called Two. And I was keen to hear what it was about, and I'll tell you a bit later on in the podcast.
Should look forward to hearing about that.
Okay.
Now, let's start at the cinema, shall we?
We shall.
Now, Simon, let's go back to the early 2000s.
Yes.
Brad Pitt, yes. George Clooney, Matt Damon, and the Oceans series, yes. The 11, 12, and 13.
Yeah.
I was a fan, were you?
I was a fan of the first. I remember going to look to it and enjoying it. I think I saw the second, but I'm not sure. And I didn't see the third. perhaps, Steve, I felt I knew what I was going to get by then, which is kind of how I felt about this new film, Steve, the Ocean's 8. Look, I was entertained, you know, don't get me wrong, I did enjoy it, but I suppose in an expected sort of a way, not in a fresh way. And I've been thinking about this over the last day or two, and I think you have too, Steve, and at the end of it, I have to say I'm just a little bit disappointed.
Well, I wouldn't go as far as being disappointed. I confess, I actually quite enjoyed it. It was not everything I wanted it to be, but it was a lot more than I think maybe you got out of it. So let's do a very quick setup first of all, shall we?
Let's do that.
We've got Sandra Bullock playing the eponymous Debbie Ocean,
yes,
who is apparently the sister of, we discover, the late Danny Ocean. That was George Clooney's character in the last trio of films.
And can you just quickly, I'm just going to ask you, because I didn't see the last one, Steve. Did his character die off in the last of the third movies?
Not that I have any recollection, no. I don't remember that happening. I think that having killed him off would have put an absolute end to that particular series. It would have been a little bit final. So as far as I was aware, he was still alive, but no, we start off early on in the film with her visiting his tomb, in fact.
Yes.
So
indeed.
But we actually, the film actually starts, if you remember, with her having a parole hearing, which is very, very familiar to anyone who saw Ocean's 11, because that's basically how that one started with Danny Ocean.
Talk about paying homage.
Just a little bit, yeah. But anyway, but then she gets out, and they don't go anywhere near Las Vegas. There's no casinos involved. Instead, she puts together her own crew to rip off a Cartier necklace worth Brazilians of dollars that's going to be around the neck of a famous actress who's going to be hosting the Met Gala in New York. Mm-hmm. And so she assembles a crew. Each one has their own special little talents, and they all pull it together to do this great big job, and you expect the same things. You've got the same ideas of scams and tricks and clevernesses.
Yep.
And that's about it, really. There's nothing yet that's terribly different from what we saw Clooney and Pitt and the rest doing.
Yes, I don't think you need to say much more about the plot, because it'll follow its course as you probably would expect. I think the key thing to take away as to whether or not you enjoy this is, to what extent did the cast spark off each other? To what extent does the script zing, give you some dash of humor, of some wit? at that level, is this gelling? And I thought it was a bit of a mixed bag for me. I thought, Steve, that some of the cast enjoyed themselves and did well, and some felt a little bit flat. In fact, I think the two lead actors, Sandra Bullock and Cate Blanchett, didn't work for me. I thought Blanchett wasn't given much of a backstory. We didn't really know much about her, did we? And she and Sandra Bullock's character, I didn't think really zinged along. And I thought Sandra Bullock also was okay, but she was Sandra Bullock. We know what to expect from her. She wasn't bad, but she wasn't great. Am I being a bit harsh there, do you think, or not?
No, I think that's a pretty fair reading, to be perfectly honest. I mean, Cate Blanchett's character was given, as you say, very little to do. She plays Lou, who is sort of a not terribly well-defined partner to Debbie Ocean. No backstory. No consistent accent, even, really, to be fair. There's hints at some stage that she might be Australian, or at least she's from Australia.
Yes, that's right.
But her accent is clearly still somewhere halfway across the Pacific. It was a bit of a disappointing go there. But that, Bullock is good, though. I mean, she's got a lot of presence. She was clearly having a lot of fun doing this. Her German was fantastic. I didn't realise that's actually her first language.
Yes, apparently so. Yeah. That's right.
So she was great. But it was the supporting cast who really pulled it together. Helena Bonham Carter can do no wrong, as far as I'm concerned.
Now, I have to ask you about this, because I did enjoy her performance, and I thought she really relished her role. But isn't Helena Bonham Carter always that slightly zany, kooky, with the frizzed-up hairstyle and the weird glasses? Isn't she always playing roles like that, give or take?
Oh, she was playing herself, definitely. She was playing the
time. Yeah, I mean, I enjoyed it, but I kind of, that's kind of what she does.
But that's why she's so good at it.
Yeah, that's why. She's had lots of practice, exactly.
Exactly, and I mean, she was Irish for no reason that I could figure, but, again, yeah. She did it with a certain pizzazz. Anne Hathaway, as the actress they sort of enlist to bring the jewels on to display. I mean, they probably paid her for doing this, but no one who's having that much fun should be getting paid for it.
No, I agree with you. I actually think, for me, she was kind of stole the show for me. I really enjoyed her performance. I thought you could argue she overacted it a bit, but she was such relish that I just thought, she's having a lot of fun, and I was enjoying watching her. I thought some of the other actors and the crew, as you call them, Steve, were good, but again, a little underused. I think Mindy Kaling and Awkwafina, we didn't see so much of them. Rihanna was having a pretty good time, I thought, is it Jennifer Paulson? Sarah Paulson, Sarah, I beg your pardon, who played Tammy. I thought, she had a good time too. I mean, I don't sound like I'm being too mean and stingy about this. I mean, I think generally it kicked along quite well, and there were some good laughs and but just felt a little bit of a well-worn track, I guess, is what I would take away from it.
There's a but. Go on, let's hear your but, Simon.
Well, I think we need to get a different view on this, because I think one of the things that I was asking myself, Steve, watching this was, and as you mentioned at the beginning, here's another female version of a male story. We saw the same with Ghostbusters last year. Is there sort of a bit of, is there a bit of tokenism going on here? Is it a little sense of patronization that you're saying, with the men did it, let the women have a go? Or is that just a genuinely good idea that people are actually craving for, excuse the pun? So should we get a female view?
If only, I mean, we could. I mean, here's you and me, male, pale and stale, and we're holding forth on a film made by women, and to, I'm going to guess, to a certain degree, for women. If only there were an actual woman who could help us out with this.
If only there were.
Here is our regular, intrepid guest reporter, Debbie, who came with me on Friday night to see Ocean's 8, and let's see what she's got to say.
Excellent idea. Debbie, hello.
Hi, Simon.
So, I'm just curious, what do you think about the whole idea, the whole concept of taking a story that was very successful with an all-male cast and translating it to a female version of effectively the same story?
I'm all for it. I think it's time for women to take stuff back. I think that's what we're doing. Showing we can do it better.
Okay. See, the question... Okay, fair enough. The question I had, though, was, mm-hmm. why not just come up with your own, another story about an all-woman crew? Why kind of replicate the male Ocean story? Is that, I just wonder if that felt a little bit, I don't know, what's the word I'm looking, searching my brain for?
Yeah.
Just a little bit, not certainly not a genuine or fresh take on a story. Anyway.
Derivative? Yeah, I know what you're talking about. I understand what you're saying. And I think that there have been quite a few excellent films, you know, by women, with women in them. But I think there is kind of a mood right now of women sort of just taking things back in a way and saying, you know, there's this whole male-dominated industry, there's male-dominated movies, and hey, you know, we're just going to take it back. We're gonna redo it. We're going to make it ours, I guess.
Yeah. Oh, well, that's completely, a good way to look at it. I mean,
sure.
What of the film? I mean, did you actually enjoy the film?
I loved it. I saw it twice, actually. I saw it on Friday night and on Saturday night. So twice in a row. And when I was sitting in the theater on Saturday night, I thought to myself, oh, am I actually seeing this again? Am I going to enjoy this? And then the moment the movie started, I was drawn in and never once again thought about the fact that I had already seen it just night before. So I really enjoyed it. I thought it was great. I mean,
and which part of it worked for you best? Was it the interplay between the characters, the story, the script?
Yeah, I thought the story was great. And seeing it the second time, I saw a few things I hadn't quite noticed the first time because it was a fairly intricate story. And of course, I knew, you know, no spoilers, but I knew what was going to happen in the end. So I was kind of watching it with that in mind.
Yes.
I absolutely love Anne Hathaway. As a friend of mine said, you know, I could watch her reading the news. She's brilliant. And Helena Bonham Carter was absolutely brilliant as well. Everybody was good in it, but those two ladies, I think, were the best. They were amazing. And I think it was the interplay, the characters, the interplay between the characters was, I thought, pretty sparkling. I didn't think that the interplay between Debbie Ocean and Lou was really that chemical. I didn't think there was a lot of chemistry there, unfortunately.
I think Steve and I would agree with you on that.
That was the one thing that was missing.
Okay, interesting. Yeah. All right. Well, okay, thank you very much. We're going to call on your services a little bit later on in our podcast because there's another piece of music we'd like you to hear from you about. But for now, Debbie, thanks very much.
Okay, thank you.
I think that was fair comment.
I think it was. Interesting that Debbie also picked up on Anne Hathaway and Helena Bonham Carter, interesting. But it's always good to get a different view on these things, Steve. As you say, I agree with the male and pale. I don't know about the stale part.
I'm also not
sure.
We've
got a few more kilometres on the tread yet. But anyway, go on.
Also, dismissing reading the news as something intrinsically...
I was going to say. Anyway.
It's an underrated art form, isn't it, Simon?
It is. My word. Yeah.
I will just very quickly comment, incidentally, on the racial politics. Since we talked about the sexual politics of Ocean's 8, the racial politics I did think were a bit questionable.
Okay, go on.
Sandra Bullock, Kate Blanchett, Sarah Paulson, Helena Bonham Carter, Anne Hathaway, given loads to do, fleshed out characters, lots and lots of interestingness is going on.
Yeah.
Mindy Kaling, Awkwafina, and Rihanna came in, did their jobs, and then were promptly ushered off the screen. Is it just me, or is it... did they really not give the non-white girls anything to do?
I think that I would agree with you with reference to two of those three, Mindy Kaling and Awkwafina. I do think Rihanna had a bit more of a prominent role, I think generally you're right, though. I think you are right. Why, you know, if you're going to go down the road, that sort of Me Too road of taking a fresh look at all this and turning it over and giving people a voice, why not take one or two of those central characters and give them to people from a different background? Why not? Indeed.
Yeah.
Good point.
So we've now decided we'll see women, right? As well, should. But yeah, the ethnics were still catching up on those guys yet a little bit. And I thought it just felt a bit pointed to me. I mean, Rihanna, I agree. She probably did the best of all. That's simply because she's got so much presence of her own.
Yes. Yeah, exactly right. A big name in her own right. Yes.
I think that she was the one who took what they gave her and said, right, I'm going to make something of this. But they didn't give her a whole lot. Whereas, let's say, Sarah Paulson, who is notionally the fence, who, I mean, I don't think the writers really understand what a fence does. She was the quartermaster.
Yes.
But anyway, moving swiftly onwards, because we could flog that one to death. Now, I've got a terrible confession to make.
Go on.
Right, we said at the start of the film, of the podcast, I beg your pardon, that Hereditary is being billed as the scariest film since The Exorcist.
Yes.
Now, I saw The Exorcist 20 mumble years ago, longer ago than I really like to admit, and it still gives me the screaming heebie-jeebies to think about it.
Right.
And so I would love to go and see Hereditary. I've seen the trailers and it looks magnificent. And it's got Toni Collette and it's got Anne Dowd in it, both of them. And yet I don't quite know I can bring myself to see it. So Simon, you're going to have to sell it to me.
Okay. Well, I think you absolutely should see it. But I've got a bit of an odd reason for wanting you to see this film, Steve. I've written this on our website, cravepodcast.com. This is, as you say, if you're billing a film as The Exorcist, and I think most people would recall that The Exorcist basically involves a story of demonic possession.
Absolutely.
So if you're selling this film called Hereditary as such, you are, and I'm saying all this because I don't want to be accused of putting a spoiler into the discussion, but we are talking about a story that deals with possession. That's the base of the whole enterprise.
Right.
But here's the but. There's an excellent cast, an excellent director, and a slow burn to this film.
Okay.
It's quite a long film, and for the first, I would say the first, easily the first half, maybe the first two thirds, it really plays more like a psychological drama than a horror movie.
Oh, okay.
And I think it's all the better for that. It's genuinely odd. It's genuinely a film which keeps you guessing as to what's going on. I won't give too much of the plot away. You've got a family. The mother is played by Toni Collette. She and her husband, Gabriel Byrne, have two kids, a daughter called Charlie and a son called Peter. They live in a big house. Of course they do. And their grandmother has recently died. And we find out very early on, I don't want to give too much away, but this is important to say, a piece of information you learn early in the film, grandmother was a bit odd, seemed to be dabbling in this and that.
Ooh.
And not only that, we find out that the family has had a history over a few generations of mental instability.
Excellent.
So that feeds into the whole idea of these odd occurrences that start happening to the family. Is it real? Is it imagined? Is it part of their mental hereditary mental illness, perhaps?
Okay.
So that, I thought, worked very, very well. It's not a fast-moving film in that first part. It takes its time. There's some lovely directing going on here where time is taken with the shots. Ari Aster is the name of the director, and I just thought, oh, this is good. Toni Collette has received a lot of praise, Steve, for her role, and I think she deserves it. She's struggling to cope with what's going on around her, these weird occurrences happening to her children, disasters occur, she's not sure what to make of them, she's struggling to maintain her sanity. She plays that role really well. There's a fantastic character played by Anne Dowd, who we both lauded recently in The Handmaid's Tale.
Yes.
And she's again very good in this film. And so it just works fantastically well. But at some point you get to the supernatural horror stuff.
Okay.
And when you get there, my reaction was, yes, it's well delivered. It does give you some frights and some scares. But that other film I was watching, which was, I guess, believable in a very tense, dramatic way, is no longer believable because we've entered the realm of things happening which can't be true.
Ah.
And somehow Of course, if you're a fan of supernatural horrors films, you'll go along with it and have a cracking good time. But I just found at the end, I felt, oh, you know what? I can actually dismiss all this part of the film. It's all a bit silly. And I didn't want to feel that, but I did. And so I would actually, if you do get the chance to see this, Steve, got on the wrong side of the bed that day. But that's what I felt like. I felt like the ultimate experience was spoiled for me by the inevitability of the horror aspect, and I would have preferred it not to have had that part.
Of it at all. That's an awful shame, because the trailer makes it look absolutely brilliant, very intense.
It is extremely intense. It's heavy going.
Yes.
There are some genuine frights. You know, I thought a couple of scenes there where you thought, whoa, they're shocking. You're not expecting them. The director and the editor do an excellent job at keeping you on edge. So there's no doubt about that. I just felt the quality of the drama was so good early on.
Yeah.
It felt a shame that it had to be turned into a horror movie. If that makes any sense, I don't know if it does.
No, I think I can understand what you're trying to say. And obviously, you're skirting around the issue of spoilers very, very carefully.
Yeah, I don't really want to say too much more about that. But the Hereditary name and the title is a very interesting name, because it could refer to the aforementioned mental illness in the family, and that's what I thought maybe it was playing on. But there is another reason put forward as to why the film could be called Hereditary, and I won't say any more than that. But it is a film, I think, you know what, Eric, if you get a chance, I wouldn't mind you getting to see that, and we could even briefly revisit it next podcast, because you might think I'm barking mad for making this point.
No, I think I might just have to break down and you know, basically harden up.
Oh, you have to do that, yes.
I think I do, yeah.
Go on, see it. Go on. Yeah. Hey, so.
I think it might be time to change pace a little bit here. Yeah?
Yeah, I think so. I think it is. Yep. I think that I would. A bit of light relief would be excellent. And what I wonder is, if we change from music, some movies to music, Steve, would One Direction's Niall Horan have provided some light relief for me? This is the question of the day.
Relief, yes, but I tell you, it would have been very, very light. We said that Hereditary Hereditary was intense. Niall Horan's show.
Yes.
I don't think intense is where we're going to go with this one.
Okay, well, that's not necessarily a bad thing, of course.
Now you're not known to be a One Direction fan, are you?
No. In a word.
And to be absolutely fair, neither am I, really. I mean, I was there, and I sat through it, and I thought he was perfectly agreeable and perfectly charming and pleasant. However, yes, once again, if only there was someone who had been at the show who appreciates such things, who could give us a slightly more balanced and nuanced view of it. What do you know? Here's Debbie.
Simon.
Hello again, Debbie. Welcome back.
Oh, thank you.
Two appearances in one podcast. Goodness.
I know.
Are we paying you double time?
I hope so. That's right.
Good. So, Niall Horan, One Direction.
Well, Niall and I go way back. Oh. So, yeah. No, I've been a fan of One Direction kind of since the beginning, really. I've seen them several times, both here and in the U.S.
And had you seen him do a solo show before?
No, I guess this is his first tour. I do have his album and have enjoyed it, so I was really looking forward to the concert. And I really enjoyed it. I thought he was quite good. I think it might have been an intense show had you been a very young One Direction fan. Although I did see moms there with their, you know, younger daughters, mm-hmm. and they were enjoying it as much as the young women. So I think Niall has quite a an attraction for women of all ages.
I was going to ask you what sort of front man he was. Is he a joke telling, dancing, charismatic sort of a guy? How does he perform up front on stage?
Yeah, I wouldn't call him joke telling. I think he was more charming, yep. just oh, what's the word I want to use? Like his music just kind of speaks to your soul a little bit. You know, I think he tugs at the heart of a lot of these young women, both through his lyrics and his voice.
Yeah. We are talking pop, right?
Yeah. Yeah, definitely pop music. You know, all of the guys from One Direction after they broke up, I think they all went in different directions. That's kind of funny.
Yes.
Different directions. yeah, and his is a little bit more of, oh gosh, how do I want to say it? What's that? Yeah, kind of more folk pop, I guess. You know, singer-songwriter type.
Yeah. Okay.
Yep.
And... Well, that's interesting because I kind of imagine for the younger audience, I wonder if they would have been clamoring for sort of faster, hippier pop, but that's not quite what he gives them.
Not really. I mean, yes, there's some songs that are, you know, faster paced than others, but I think his real strength is in his voice and in lyrics. That's what I would say.
Are we talking love songs predominantly?
I think there were some definite love songs in there.
Yeah. You know, so I'm interested because you've, as you say, you've seen the band and you've followed them, the careers of the individual members since.
Right.
Is this a guy who you think you could see him being in the business for quite a long time and really developing a really successful independent career? He's got the talent for that?
Yeah, I think so. I think all of those guys have talent. You know, just because they were sort of artificially brought together, you know, by Simon Cowell, I think it was. Yeah, I don't think that means they don't have talent. I think they all have some interesting talent. I've followed the careers of all of those guys, and they're all quite different. But I think, yeah, I think Niall has that kind of sweet, charming, more voice and lyric driven music. And I think that if he sticks with that, I think he'll do well.
I take it then if he comes back, you might just trot along for another outing.
I think I would definitely see him again. Yeah.
Oh, good stuff. Okay. Mm-hmm. Debbie, thank you so much.
Thanks, Simon.
Now, Simon, I have to mention, though, there is one thing that you would have approved of very definitely.
Oh, yes.
At Niall's show. Now, we went to see another One Direction lad back in December. That was Harry Styles. And
right.
One of the things that these fellas do is to sort of try and demonstrate a little bit of a musical hinterland. They obviously show where their influences come from. And so,
yes.
So Harry Styles played The Chain by Fleetwood Mac.
Right.
Which obviously involved very little of him, oddly enough.
Okay.
Yeah. Now, Niall decided that he was going to do Dancing in the Dark.
You're kidding me.
He actually said that it was from his all-time favourite... singer, songwriter, human being.
Right.
I think even you wouldn't go quite that far, would you?
No, I wouldn't quite go that far. Well, he's just soared into the upper stratosphere in my estimation.
Well, you would have been reasonably impressed with the performance he did of Dancing in the Dark. I have a video of it which needs to go on YouTube very shortly.
Okay.
And it wasn't bad.
Right. Well, that's... Okay, well, that's very interesting. And he, we're talking about Bruce Springsteen, of course.
Obviously.
Yeah, well, that's, yes, fantastic. Well,
now, if you're going to do a Springsteen song, I guess that's probably about as conventional and straight down the line as you're going to get. I mean, he didn't pick anything from The Ghost of Tom Joad, for example.
No. He's talking the very commercial end of Bruce Springsteen. But
very, very much so, yes.
Yeah, in fact, that is his biggest single hit, I think. So, oh, well, still...
kudos.
All credit due to him. Yeah.
Yes, I thought you'd approve of that.
Oh, thank you so much. Yes. I appreciate you mentioning it.
Now, at the other end of the musical spectrum, because Niall Horan's definitely very agreeable.
Yes.
Very, very pleasant. You could if you were pushed, you could take your granny to see him.
Right.
However, something tells me that you wouldn't take your granny to see Alien Weaponry.
And you'd be so right. Yes. We are talking about Alien Weaponry, a three-piece teenage heavy metal band from Northland, New Zealand, who I did report on for the podcast and on the website back in March when they played live at the Auckland City Limits Festival.
Yeah, and you were quite taken with them, weren't you?
They were passionate and energetic and full of politics and dynamism, and they thrashed their long hair about the stage like there was no tomorrow, and I thought it was infectiously good, even though I'm not a heavy metal fan. I'm still not really a heavy metal fan, but they have just put out an album this last week. It's called Two. And I was interested to see it, to see as much as anything else, how they translated that on stage vibrancy onto a recorded record, onto a piece of recorded music. And, and the answer is they did a pretty good job. And I've just, there's a piece on the website about this now. They continue that full-on sort of direct, uncompromising battle cry for justice for Maori. That's really what the message of this whole album. The word tu, I think it's got several meanings in Maori, Steve, but I did a quick bit of a research. It mostly is referred to as a wound or an injury or the act of being wounded or injured.
Oh, okay.
Which I guess is a comment on what's happened to Maori over history. But I guess wounded does not mean defeated, does it? And I think that's very much at the core of this film. It's a film of this album. It's all about reflecting on some of the stories, past and present, of what's happened to Maori, and issuing a call to arms, if you like, to stand up for them themselves. These three lads, they don't look Maori. I know that I think they've got some Maori heritage. At least a couple of them went to the up north when they were young, to the Maori Kohangareo language nests, the immersion language schools. Apparently they, in their family, they grew up hearing stories of what had happened in some of Maori history, the battles and some of the main characters. So they kind of know, you know, they've got a pretty broad idea of what they're on about here. And then there's the album. They've taken the big sound of the guitars and the crashing drums, finessed it a little bit. There's a few ancient Maori instruments there, like an old flute and so forth, the horn, the conch, I mean, a little bit of keyboard, and they've interwoven a couple of examples of radio audio. There's a song where they've taken a clip of an RNZ interview between Kim Hill and Don Brash, and
now
used that to...
there's something I never thought I'd hear on a heavy metal record.
Well, there you are, and it works really, really well, really well.
I'm going to guess Kim Hill and Don Brash never expected to hear that on a heavy metal record.
No, I think not. I don't know if either of them know it yet, but... it's the song is called Whispers, and in the clip we hear Don Brash talking about Maori being Stone Age and never having had it so good since they were colonized, and Kim Hill trying to sort of point out the error of his ways and perhaps following that line of argument. But
God bless Kim Hill.
Yes. So the album is just a full on, full throated, call to action. The thing is, as I say, I mean, I'm not really a heavy metal fan. Are you, Steve? Are you into heavy metal? Are you into Black Sabbath and whatever? Iron Maiden?
If the wind's blown the right way, I can be, but it has to be good stuff.
Right. I mean, I've always found it a little bit too repetitive and monotonous, and that isn't a lot of it about Satan and sex and depression and stuff? Aren't those some of the big themes?
They can be, yes. So that's just like your typical Black Sabbath song, really.
Yeah. So I was... And I would still say that in some ways, this, if you're going to sit and listen to the whole album in one go, you know, it's a bit of an assault on the senses. There's not a lot of light and shade. It's full on heavy metal. The vocals are often just yelled at you.
Right.
There's a very, very good album CD sleeve and booklet with translations of the Te Reo songs, with good artwork and some background. And I kind of forgave the fact that I'm not a big heavy metal fan. I just got so caught up in the energy of their message that I actually felt myself feeling quite hopeful and almost, I'd have no reason to be proud, but sort of proud of the fact that young New Zealanders still had the passion and the guts to go out and say something that really meant something to them. And I
think that right there is probably the recommendation we're looking for, isn't it, really?
I'm probably not going to sit down and listen to the whole thing many, many times. I'll probably pick and choose my songs here and there, but it feels like a really urgent statement. And although you could dismiss young people as just, you know, naive and they see the world as black and white, these young guys that I should mention their names again, forgive me for not doing so earlier. So there's two brothers, Louis de Jong, Henry de Jong, and Ethan Trembath. And they've got themselves informed about things. They've got a view. They want to share it. They're not holding back. There's fire in their belly. Good on them. That's what I say.
You've sold me. I'm going to give it a look, definitely.
Yeah. Just wait, make sure you've got some good earmuffs.
You're on. Sounds good to me.
Okay, good.
So that's been some good entertainment for us for the last couple of weeks. There's some interesting things coming up in the near future as well.
Yeah, there are. We've got a few things on our website to have a look at, Steve, but there's a bit of news that came across last week, which I just took my fancy a little bit, because when I was a teenager, I'm a little bit older than you, when I was a teenager, the biggest movie star on the planet in that sort of, I guess, early to mid to late, even late 70s was Clint Eastwood.
Yes.
Yeah, he had Dirty Harry and all those other movies he did. He was just... He was a bit of a right winger, but he was a famous, successful movie star.
And he was everywhere, wasn't he?
He was. And he then turned into a very successful Oscar-winning director later in his career.
And now he's doing a bit of both, isn't he?
Yeah. He's 88 years old, and he's now making another film, directing and acting in it, called The Mule. And he's playing a bloke who his business is about to collapse. He's offered a job to go driving, and it turns out he's become an unbeknowing drug courier for a Mexican cartel. That's the advanced publicity, and he's quite good at it, apparently.
I would imagine anything Clint Eastwood decides he wants to do, he's probably going to be fairly good at it.
That's right.
So, yeah, they've just started filming this. I'm guessing it'll probably come out next year.
Yeah, I hope he's around to see it. I'm sure he will be somehow.
Something tells me he cannot be killed by conventional weapons.
I think that's true. So I'm kind of... I mean, I think some of his work as a director has been quite good, and not all of them have worked, but I'd be interested to see how it goes and how he performs in front of the camera again.
Absolutely.
Anyway, that's just a bit of news on by the by. Steve, you've, as usual, kept the website well stocked with tidbits of concerts coming up and here and there. Any in particular that have taken your notice in the last week or two?
Yeah, there's a couple of decent announcements. There's a singer-songwriter named Miguel, mm-hmm. Down the R&B end of the spectrum. He's going to be coming to New Zealand, coming to Auckland, in fact, in July, so not far off now. It's going to be Saturday the 14th. He's going to be at the Logan Campbell Centre. Yes. Slightly more my tempo, to be fair. The Dire Straits Experience. Not your actual Dire Straits
show.
Very much a tribute act. Yeah. They're coming to Auckland. I don't have the date in front of me, but go to our website, cravepodcast.com, and you'll find it.
Okay.
Julia Deans. I don't know if you're familiar with that name.
That's not the ice skater. No, I'm thinking of someone else.
No, that's...
sorry.
Christopher Jane Torvill and Christopher Dean.
Yes.
So you're not even remotely close.
No.
No.
What was I thinking?
Kiwi singer-songwriter has released her second album, We Light Fire. Right. And the big focus on this is going to be the... Tying back into something we were talking about earlier in the podcast. Yeah. The fact that women simply don't get the breaks that men get in the music business.
Okay.
And it's a big focus for her. Okay. As she puts it, the gender disparity conversation. She's using this tour as a platform to create opportunities for females in New Zealand. And so all the support artists on the tour will be locally appointed with a focus on female identifying bands or solo artists.
Okay.
Even the team behind the tour, the booking agents, the promoters, the publicists, the band and the touring crew are predominantly women. So there's an extensive tour that takes in everywhere from Dunedin up to Lee.
Yes.
Okay, and finishing obviously in Auckland at the Tuning Fork on the 1st of September. And again, full schedule and dates at cravepodcast.com.
Okay. Oh, that sounds like a good show to catch if we can. Good.
Absolutely. And then totally at 90 degrees from all of that.
Yes.
Bill Bailey.
Ah, the British... comedian.
He's very, very hard to pin down. This is his Earl of Whimsy tour.
Okay.
And again from Dunedin all the way up to Auckland.
Great. Good.
Taking in all the usual suspects along the way.
Okay, cool. And there are one or two movies of interest, or certainly that promise to be of the mainstream popular variety. Remembering, of course, in the Northern Hemisphere, it's summer over there, and they trot out all the blockbusters, don't they? So I think this coming week we've got a sort of a buddy movie called Tag.
Yes.
We've got Jeremy Renner in it and a few other lads. It looks like it could be amusing.
I think lads is the word, though. It does look like a terribly laddie kind of film, doesn't it?
It looks very laddie. A bit like... I've gone out of my mind, but they did three of them in the end. Anyway, never mind. The lads who went to Las Vegas and got drunk and woke up with a tiger in the room.
The Hangover.
It sounds a little bit sort of that type of genre.
It could well be, yes. But I know what you're going to mention next, and I'm begging you not to, but you're going to anyway.
Well, I have to now because I've started.
I know.
Well, it's been on the trailered and previewed for seems like months, but this is the follow-up to the 2015 very, very commercially successful Jurassic World adventure. And this one, it's called Jurassic World Fallen Kingdom, and it starts next week. And I think the last one earned $2 billion at the box office. So
okay, can we rephrase that?
Yes.
It took $2 billion. Earned implies in some way it deserved it.
Hook 2 billion. Fair enough. Good point. Yes.
It was pants.
But you know what? My soon-to-be seven-year-old grandson can't wait. That probably tells you something.
It does a little bit, yes.
It's all those dinosaurs. Yes, yes, yes. Anyway, so, and I'm sure we'll find other more critically acclaimed work to think about as well.
Absolutely.
But in the meantime, it's been good to talk to you. Thanks for listening. We're always pleased to hear from you here at Crave. Steve and I always happy to get some comments from you. You can email us on podcast@cravepodcast.com.
You can find us on Facebook. You can follow us on Twitter. We're at Crave Podcast.
So we are. I'm Simon Mercer.
I'm Steve McCabe.
That's what's been entertaining us this week.
Certainly is.